Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Tieri Jones was waiting for her fourth novel to be published when she got the phone call that, in this day and age, most every writer dreams of.
So I said hello, and she said, "Hi, this is Oprah." And I pulled a car over, and she was telling me how she wanted to use An American Marriage for her book club. And what did I think of that? And I said, "Yes, ma'am." But before that, I was saying, "Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness." And I couldn't stop kind of laughing, like I could not believe that this was my life.
When Jones's book came out in February, it went straight to the New York Times bestseller list. An American Marriage is a story of what happens to a loving couple who are forced apart by circumstance. The book is set in the South, especially in Jones's hometown of Atlanta, a place she's done a lot of thinking and writing about. And after a long time away, she's getting ready to come back home. Here's our conversation.
Tieri Jones, I want to clear up one very important question right here at the beginning. On page 13 of An American Marriage, your characters, Roy and Celestial, are driving to Louisiana down I-10, and there's hip-hop thumping in their Honda Accord.
And I know what you're going to ask.
And then you're going to write, something happens to Celestial, and Roy is a little worried about her, and he said, "What's wrong?" I asked, turning down the volume of the greatest hip-hop album in history, which you then never again mention. Tieri, what is the greatest hip-hop album in history?
See, I feel that question is not what I think is the greatest hip-hop album in history versus what Roy thinks is the greatest hip-hop album in history.
Okay, then what does Roy think the greatest hip-hop album in history is?
I'm not even going to answer that. I'm going to be really difficult. There are like three things that I never identify in this book, and people are always asking me about them, but I feel like I withheld that information purposely. And I think part of the reason why I withheld that particular detail is that early in the book, like you said, is page 13, that would then, for different readers, it would seem to be a shorthand for Roy's personality, and I did not want to give him away that early.
Huh. So, but on page 130, you could have answered that, right?
Well, I just let it go. I mean, but I do think that Roy would be the kind of person to appreciate "It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back."
I am so glad you said that, because that is what I wrote down as the correct answer. It feels like you divined the correct answer here. Of course, I'm a 54-year-old white guy. I'm not sure I should be given this answer, but that was what I would have selected.
Don't believe the hype.
Yes.
And also what I would have selected for Roy. So I'm glad we're thinking alike there.
Me too. It's actually, this interview is off to a great start.
It's off. We're doing well. So I want to ask, first of all, about the title of this book. I know from listening to interviews with you that this was a title that you sort of hesitated about, right?
Yes. I mean, it was my idea, but I was just throwing it out as a brainstorming activity. I didn't mean for it to be a real title. I was even joking. I said, "We'll call it An American Marriage, because whenever you say something is American, it sounds really important." And that was just like my joke. I even said that my cat was writing a memoir and it was going to be called American Feline. You know, I was just being cute. And my editor said that he really liked the title. And I was really torn, because I felt like An American Marriage sounded like a novel. I always say this, it sounded like a novel about some white people in Connecticut having feelings, getting a divorce or something. And I felt like that title, I was worried that it would be disguising the book. Kind of like the way when they look at your book cover, they tell you, "Oh, we don't want to put a black face on the front of this book, because it would marginalize it or stigmatize it." I mean, the first time that was brought to me, I was almost in tears because I said to them, I said, have you all noticed that I have a black face on the front of my head? So when you say that having a black face on the book, you know, would relegate it to the remainder bins, how do you think that makes me feel as a person? So I worried that this title was another kind of effort like that. And so I was really hesitant, and I called my mentor, Pearl Clegg, who was my teacher when I was a student at Spelman College, and I asked her, what did she think about it? And she completely understood my hesitation and my worry. And I told her I had never been called American before. Like, when people say something is American, I don't think they're talking about me. And she says, just because when someone says American, they're not talking about you. They should be talking about you because you are American. Your character's experience is American. And if you want that title, you have a right to it. Don't think that if you don't like it, you just don't like it. But don't think that that is not yours to have should you want it.
It also reminds me, do you know that book, An American Tragedy? That's like
Dreiser,
Theodore.
Yes.
Yeah, Dreiser back in the 20s. I have to say that was one of the books that I read in high school that I felt like I was sort of forced to read in high school. But just the title alone makes it feel, it gives it an ambition and a weight that it is standing for something bigger than itself. And I feel like this book does the same thing, that, you know, just by those three words, hearing it, it feels like it opens it up in a way that I think Pearl Clegg was talking about.
Well, you know, too, I mean, when I decided that, okay, maybe we would use it, and then I was coming up with variants on it, like Portrait of American Marriage, Story of an American Marriage, all these things I was doing, I think that I had a fear of claiming a title with such ambition that I felt immodest to use this title, and I was trying to just make it just a little smaller, I think. And my editor, he told me that I was selling myself and my novel short. And that he says, if you are reluctant to take this title because you think that your story cannot stand up to it, doesn't have the weight to handle the title, he said, I love this word. He said, I implore you to reconsider. And like, no one had ever implored me before.
I was going to say, once you've been implored, how can you say no, right?
And I thought about it, and I just decided that once I got over just using the word American as a self-identifier, the next step was really to claim the ambition of my ideas. And I decided that even if this wasn't the proper title for it, or if it wasn't successful as a title, that I had to, for my own self, accept and embrace the title. So I told him, I said, okay, let's call it An American Marriage. And he said, oh, thank goodness, because we have already mocked up the covers. emailed them to me immediately.
Yeah, great. Well, I want to back up just a little bit for the original idea of this book. Yeah, it's about a young couple, happy and in love, and then a bomb drops into their relationship when the husband is accused of a crime, accused and convicted of a crime that he did not commit. Was that something that kind of came from research you had done, or did you know families, couples that this had happened to?
I actually don't know anyone who has been wrongfully incarcerated, but I have known people who have been incarcerated. And one thing that I realized when I was writing this book and also doing research is that the thing that makes Roy's experience significant to him, to himself and into his family, it's really that he's incarcerated at all. That the wrongful part is an adjective, but the real thing that happened to him was that he was incarcerated. And, you know, mass incarceration, there's so many incarcerated people that the ripple effects of incarceration affects people in all walks of life in ways that you may not even realize it, but particularly in the African-American community, incarceration is expensive. And if you have incarcerated people in your family, even if it's your cousin or even if they're not in your family, just someone you know, there's just so much of the money in your life going to support people who are incarcerated, and just the emotional, the constant specter that incarceration could come and get you, as it were. Like, it could just come out of nowhere, as it happened to Roy, just wrong, as this old lady says about Roy, wrong race at the wrong time, and end up in prison. Just that fear, I think, has shaped the culture.
That mention of wrong race at wrong time, you know, as I happen to be reading this book in, you know, the last couple of weeks, sort of echoed with me through all the stories that are in the news now of immigrant families being separated. And I think this book, among other things, is about the pressure on a family, on members of a family, when they are involuntarily separated. And I just wonder whether, as you've looked at the news these last few weeks about immigrant families being separated and kids being put in these, you know, camps or whatever you'd want to call them, if any of that resonates with you for the themes of what you wrote about.
You know, it's true. I'm writing something right now. I'm reading the collected prison letters of Nelson Mandela that's going to be published by Norton in a couple of weeks. And I realized that incarceration really is family separation, that you cannot incarcerate one person. You are disrupting a community, a family. And I mean, there's all these populations of children whose mothers are incarcerated and children are in foster care. And that's just domestically. And I feel like this situation that's happening on the border, separating the parents and children, that is a very dramatic example. And it's heartbreaking, but it is not as isolated and unique as we would like to think. Our prisons are full of people's fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, parents. Every incarcerated person represents a family that has been torn apart.
An American story, right?
Sadly so.
Was this the idea, the sort of germ of all this, was this something that you set out to write about, or did you just kind of stumble across it and looking for something else?
A little of both. I've written three other novels, and they are all kind of family stories. They're set in Atlanta, which is my hometown. And I've always been interested in writing about the culture of Atlanta as I experienced it growing up in the 70s and 80s. But this time I felt that it was my fourth novel. I was 40 years old, and I wanted to try and write something that was engaging, something bigger than my own musings and observations. And I was very interested. I've been interested in the ripple effects of incarceration, you know, all my life. And I got this fellowship to go to Harvard to research it. And I was researching, and I learned really startling statistics, but I didn't have a story because I'm a storyteller. I'm not an ethnographer. I'm not a sociologist. And I do believe that literature can help us better understand the emotional and cultural impacts of issues. But I am not a writer who can write to an issue. I have to write to a place of moral ambiguity. And I was stressed out because at Harvard, we were to present our work at this big, like, you have a big presentation. All these people come. There's a luncheon, a reception. And I had been working, but I didn't have a story to show. And, I mean, time was running out. And I went home to Atlanta, and I went to the mall. And while I was there, I overheard a couple arguing. I heard the woman say, "Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for no 7 years." And he said, "I don't know what you're talking about. This wouldn't have happened to you in the first place." And I was intrigued by their argument because, for me, when I hear an argument and both people are right, yet they can't agree, that's when I know you have real moral ambiguity. And that's when I knew I had a story.
And those two lines show up in only slightly altered form in your novel.
This is true.
Without giving away any spoilers, I think it's obvious if you're reading a novel and things happen to characters and there's stresses and issues. And you talked about the moral ambiguity. And I think every character in this book does something that you can see both sides of. And it sounds like that was intentional on your part. I'm wondering whether readers have come to you or commented to you And they have a clearer idea of basically who the good guys and bad guys are in this book.
You know, sometimes people do come to me with strong opinions about, like, sometimes they say, oh, I'm Team Roy, or I'm Team Celeste, or I'm Team Andre. And it dismays me because my whole purpose in this was, and well, really my purpose in anything I write is to make it difficult to decide who's right, who's wrong. I mean, that's kind of the emotional project of everything I do. But I am struck by how so many people have different opinions about who they think is the good guy and the bad guy, which makes me think that perhaps I have achieved my goal since people can't agree on who's right and who's wrong.
Right. And one thing I think is a hallmark of a good book is that I've thought about it at the end. When I read it through, I sort of had an opinion. And then I thought about it for another day or two, and I sort of saw it from a different point of view. And I think as I've gone through and thought about it more, my opinion changes all the time. And I think that's probably what you set out to do, right, is to have people think about this situation, both in the specific and the universal, from all different angles, right?
Well, this is the thing. Roy has been in prison for a crime he does not commit, but he is still imprisoned. Celestial is his wife. They've only been married 18 months, and he wants her to wait for him for 12 years. That is already a very tall order, and it is a decision that she should not have to make. So she can't, in my opinion, she cannot be right or wrong because the decision she has to make is illegitimate.
Hmm.
So that for to put the moral weight of his incarceration on her is, that is wrong, in my opinion. And so I kind of went for all of them, all their decisions are influenced by this injustice that has happened. And that is where the clear morality piece is. The clear moral thing is that he should not have been incarcerated. How they each shoulder this burden and try to live their lives despite of it, I think each of them is heroic.
I wonder if you kind of took that into like one level deeper in this book. All the parents in this book have complicated relationships, or the relationships came from a complicated place. Was that intentional too, to just sort of say these people that we often look up to, you know, and look to for advice and counsel and sometimes think of as, you know, role models, that they had their own issues in their day too?
Well, the thing about the parents for me was the question of generation gap. I have always been fascinated by generation gap, particularly in Black communities, particularly because of my generation. I was born in 1970, so I was born 2 years after Dr. King was murdered, so I'm a post-civil rights baby. My father, on the other hand, grew up in a small town in Louisiana during Jim Crow. So I am his child of an entirely different world. And that causes communication, like failures of communication or understanding. This is a small kind of silly example, but when I wanted to become a writer, I wanted to go to school to study creative writing. My mother thought this was a ridiculous idea. She said that getting a degree in creative writing was akin to getting a degree in basketball. She says, if you are a good basketball player, no one is going to inquire after your credential. And if you have the credential, but you cannot dunk, no one is going to choose you for the team. And this was her idea about studying creative writing. My mother has a PhD in economics. My father has a PhD in political science. When I got the opportunity to go to school, I told them I was going to go because I wasn't fulfilled doing what I was doing before. And Daddy said, you know what your problem is? Your problem is that you never had to pick cotton. He said, when you pick cotton, you don't ask yourself, am I fulfilled by this cotton? You don't stand out there and say, this cotton field is not my niche. You don't say, I don't feel challenged by this cotton. He said, you just pick the goddamn cotton. And that, I think, is the generation gap. My father literally picked cotton when he was a boy. So for me to say, I want my life's work to satisfy me intellectually, emotionally, he feels like What is it about work that you don't understand, that you think that work is supposed to do these emotional things for you? And in An American Marriage, I think the parents also kind of have this idea about marriage. When Celestial says, you know, my husband has been in prison for years now. I don't feel like I'm married. I'm not emotionally fulfilled by this marriage. Everyone looking at her like, what is this emotional fulfillment you're talking about? You need to go support that man. And that, I also think, is a generation gap.
Still to come on Southbound, Terry Jones talks about what it's like to pick up the phone and find Oprah Winfrey on the other end. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation. What is the Charlotte music scene? Seriously, what is it? Where is it? How can we find it? WFAE is working on a new series of stories about the rockers, singers, and artists who helped shape the Queen City's soundscape. Submit your story now on WFAE.org/CLTmusic. Who knows? You might be featured in the series. Support for this series is provided by Ortho Carolina.
Each week on Southbound, we take a moment to highlight our listeners. This week, I want to thank Bill Diskin, who sent a nice email about our last episode featuring singer Aaron Ray. "I'm tired this morning," Bill said. "I was up most of the night listening to Aaron's album Putting on Airs. Can't wait to get back to it." Thanks for the comment, Bill. I'm glad you got absorbed in our music as much as I have. If you're like Bill and enjoy our podcast, we want to hear from you. Tweet at me, at Tommy Tomlinson, or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks to all of you who are listening. And now, back to our conversation with Terry Jones.
This book is obviously, there's parts of it in Louisiana, but most of it's set in Atlanta. And you mentioned growing up there and your parents and all. What was your upbringing like there? And how you think is it different than what people stereotypically might think of a Southerner or even a Black Southerner growing up in the South?
Well, I was born downtown Atlanta on a blustery day in November. But it's true. I really was. I was born downtown. I am from Atlanta. I grew up in Southwest Atlanta, which is a pretty much exclusively Black side of town. And it kind of travels along Cascade Road. And what I like to say about Cascade Road and Southwest Atlanta is that anything you can imagine a Black person doing it, some Black person is doing it on Cascade Road, from people engaging in crime all the way to the mayor of Atlanta. Like anything, the full range of a Black Southern experience is happening up and down the 6 or 7 miles of Cascade Road. I grew up, my parents, like I said, are professors. They teach at the historically Black colleges in Atlanta. And I grew up in an all-Black, comfortable neighborhood. And I went to a math and science high school, even though I'm not good at math or science. And I really think it hurt me emotionally to go to that high school because I spent so much of my time doing something that I wasn't good at. I was the youngest girl in my college class. I was 16 when I went to Spelman College, also in Atlanta, historically Black women's college. I think that living here in New York, New Yorkers, when I tell them I'm from Georgia, they act like I got up here on the Underground Railroad or something. You know, they're just like, "You're from Georgia? Are you okay?" No, I'm fine. And I think that is probably the stereotype of Southern life that I think my life has challenged, in that I did not grow up in a space of racial strife. I grew up segregated, yet comfortable. And a lot of people don't know that there are such worlds where, like, sometimes people say to me, "Oh, when did you first discover that Black people wrote books?" And When I was a baby, you know, I grew up in Atlanta, the chocolate city of the South. I grew up chewing on, you know, picture books, you know, teething on picture books with Black children in them. And I think that is definitely something really Southern, this concentration of Black culture, where one doesn't have to choose whether or not you want to live in a safe neighborhood or a Black neighborhood.
Another thing you deal with in this book is the sort of Black college life in Atlanta. You know, you're Celestial, like you, as a Spelman grad. Roy is a Morehouse man. And that whole Atlanta University Center with Clark and, I guess, formerly Morris Brown and those areas are something that I think from the outside is mysterious to a lot of people. And I wonder, on the inside, how do these universities and the people who go there, how do they all see one another?
Well, you know, I wrote a piece for Tin House about Spelman, and I said we were made to feel exceptional without feeling like we were exceptions. Mm. And I think that is the main thing, that once you're enrolled in a historically Black college, it may seem like a contradiction, but it's like, because you're at a Black college, you, not that you forget that you're Black, but it's not a defining variable. So your individual qualities become more significant. Like, for example, at Spelman, you know the student body president is going to be a Black woman because we're all Black women. So then the question becomes, which Black woman will you vote for? Just this idea of being able to put your demographics aside and explore your individuality. Like when I went to graduate school, I went to the University of Iowa and I went to University of Georgia. I went to a lot of schools. I went to Arizona State University. And there was so much a sense of, with the other Black students, you must support them because it's like you had to protect each other from the institution. And I did not feel this way when I was at Spelman. So there was just more room to be myself, to be my quirky, writerly, weird self.
So let's talk about how the quirky, writerly self began. What made you want to start writing? Or did you write from the time you were little? Where did all this come from?
I wrote as a little kid. I've always just loved writing. I write something pretty much every day, whether it's a letter in my journal or, you know, working on a book project or something. I loved writing, but I didn't know that writing could be my life's work. I think that when you're a kid, particularly a teenage girl, if you like to read and write, people think it means that you're nice. They don't think it means you're an intellectual, because with teenage girls, it seems that all people care about is that you're appropriate, right? You're a nice girl. Mm-hmm. And I love to say, you like to read? Great. No one ever got pregnant in the library. And that was like the end of that. But when I got to Spelman, I met Pearl Clegg, and Pearl took me up under her wing. And she also asked me once, what are you thinking? And I was getting ready to tell her, and she said, no, write it down. And in that way, she became my first audience. And I just took my relationship with her very seriously. Sometimes she let me shadow her as she went about her artist life. And she set really a sterling example to me as to how and why a person would want to be a writer, the importance of telling the stories of the people you know and love, and how, like, literature, we're making a record. Like, in 100 years, she said, if in 100 years, you know, and the world has been destroyed and someone comes and they want to see what the hell happened, they should be able to look at our books and understand what happened.
When did you convert from, this is something I enjoy and love, to this is something I'm going to do with my life? Was it at Spelman?
At Spelman, I realized that I would like to do it with my life, but I wasn't sure how to go about doing it. After Spelman, I went to the University of Iowa, not to join the famous Iowa Writers' Workshop. I had not even heard of it when I went, but I found out that it was a thing, and I thought, oh, I would like to do something like that one day, but not at Iowa. I really hated Iowa City so much. I will never go back. But
now, let me stop you there. What did you not like about Iowa City.
I hated everything. You know, who knows? Iowa City could be awesome now. I doubt it, but it could be. But just think, I came from Atlanta. I was a Southerner from a, you know, I'm a Southerner from a chocolate city. And I go up to Iowa. Before I went to Iowa, I did not emotionally process that Black people were a numerical minority in this country. I knew it. I knew it the way when people tell you that the earth is 80% water. You believe it, but you are standing on solid ground. So you don't believe it. You know it, but you don't believe it. So I went up to Iowa. I had never experienced racism before. And I've discovered that racism does not agree with me. I don't like it. So I left the University of Iowa after only, I think, 2 years into my PhD program. I wrote to Pearl and I said, Pearl, I want to leave. I'm unhappy, but I'm afraid I'll disappoint my parents. I'll disappoint the people who wrote me letters for admission. And she basically said, don't worry about them. It's not their life. It's your life. And so I left and I took a job in Texas and I was teaching remedial reading and I made a very significant purchase. I purchased this new thing. It was called a laptop computer because you could hold it on your lap. It weighed 13 pounds. I bought it on some program where they would like stretch the payments out over 24 months, no payments, no interest, something like that.
Right.
And so I bought this 13-pound laptop. Everyone was so impressed. They were like, is that the whole computer? It only weighs 13 pounds? And I was like hefting it like, yep, this is the whole computer. And I wrote a novel. I took this heavy computer to work because we didn't have computers at that job. And during my lunch break, I would take it into the ladies' lounge, as they called it, and I would work every day for an hour on a novel. And it was a terrible novel. I knew nothing about writing novels, but I finished it, and I knew that I was a person who could finish a novel. So I sent it off to an agent. The agent said no. And I don't know why. I just said, okay. And I just started writing something different. And I used that sample to go to do an MFA in creative writing. But for me, when I bought that laptop computer, I think it cost like $1,700. And if you do the math, that's equivalent of something costing about $9,000 to me today.
Oh,
like
yeah.
It was like buying a car. But once I had my laptop computer, I was serious. I felt like, okay, my whole nest egg is in this machine. Let's get serious.
And so you wrote that first novel in basically the women's room?
Yes, in the women's room. And every now and then I would hear someone say, do you hear typing? And then I would stop because I would be embarrassed. And it was, like I said, it was a dog of a novel. It was set in the same town where Roy lives in An American Marriage, which is basically my father's hometown of Oakdale, Louisiana. And I wrote it. And like I said, it wasn't a good book, but I still feel it's the best thing I ever wrote because I had my entire heart and entire pocketbook. Everything was invested in me proving to myself that I could write a novel.
So I want to talk about one of the more recent watershed moments, which is that you got a phone call from a very famous person. I've heard you tell that story a couple of times in different places, but you were in Las Vegas, right? Are you working in Vegas?
Yes, I had a fellowship at the Black Mountain Institute. So I was driving around Las Vegas in the car they gave me, a giant Chevy. So I'm driving a boat and the phone rings and it comes through the speakers and such in the car. And it was a blocked call. And I am the type of person that absolutely answers blocked calls. Because I'm nosy. I feel like that person blocked the call for a reason.
Only 9 out of 10 that will be a telemarketer, right?
But that's okay. But all you need is one time is Oprah. So I said, hello. And she said, hi, this is Oprah. And it was Oprah. She has a very distinctive voice. I would know it anywhere. And I pulled a car over and she was telling me how she wanted to use An American Marriage for her book club. And what did I think of that? And I said, yes, ma'am. But before that, I was saying, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. And I couldn't stop kind of laughing. Like, I could not believe that this was my life. Meanwhile, People were panhandlers were tapping on the window of the car, asking me for money. I was shooing them away. Oprah's talking. There was a lot going on in that 5-minute call.
I guess so. So I want to kind of deconstruct that a little bit. Before that call, did you have any idea that your book was a candidate for that? Did your publishers tell you we're going to try to get Oprah to read this book? I mean, did you have any inkling that might happen beforehand?
Yeah, no, that's not how it works. I think the publishers send all the books to the Oprah magazine.
Sure.
And I think that's where that starts, but they send all the books there. No, I had no idea. I was in a space of being very grateful that I had finished this book at all, because it took me 6 years to write the book. The book was 4 years overdue, and I had spent a full year stranded about 50 pages from the end because I couldn't figure out how to solve this love triangle I had created. And I just was so grateful that I had figured the book out. So I felt like I was already ahead. And then Oprah Winfrey calls me on the telephone and changes my life.
So now I want to talk about the 5 minutes after that. Who's the first call after that moment?
Sir, you can't call anybody. I mean, you are under a gag order. As soon as the Oprah people call you and say that they're going to use your book, the secret had to be kept for 5 months.
5 months?
That feels harder
than writing the book.
I called my agent. I mean, I don't know if that counts. Luckily, I love my agent. I called my agent and told her, and I called my publicist and told him. But only people in the loop of production can know, because it has to be a big announcement that Oprah makes the big announcement.
Right. And your publisher has to know, because they've got to print some more books, right?
Yes, but only a very few people at the publishing house. So most people had no idea.
And so no,
I felt like a spy. I felt like I had the biggest secret, and only me and my publicist. I called him every day because I had to talk to somebody.
So no friends, no family?
No. Oh, my goodness. The last person you want to tell is your mama. Can you imagine? Everybody at Cascade Methodist Church would know. No, you can't tell anybody.
But were there moments when, you know, you have a couple of moments in this book where somebody's not saying something, and one of the characters goes like, what's up? I know there's something going on. Did you not have somebody in your family saying, you look different? Is there something going on in your life?
I actually do think that holding that secret caused me to be a little withdrawn. You know, the non-disclosure you sign is no joke. Like, it's not like, it's a scary legal document. And I would not have wanted to pass that liability on to anyone.
Sure.
But Daddy said, you know, I just really think you need to get this book to Oprah. And I said, well, Daddy, you know, I've heard that if Oprah selects your book, Daddy, that you have to sign all this. They have to sign all this paperwork, and that, you know, there'll be penalties. And it would, you know, just kind of laid all this out for him. And he said, wow, if something like that happened to you, baby, I would not want to know. So I appreciated that, because when the big announcement was made, I got to say, well, Daddy, you told me you didn't want to know. So he wouldn't feel like I had kept this thing from him, because that is the real challenge to your relationships, is that there's going to be a big announcement on television, and people who feel they are intimate with you will feel like you didn't share with them this thing. It makes them feel like they're outsiders to your heart. So what I did was, the night before the big announcement, I called my family and a few other people, and I said, turn on CBS This Morning at 8:00, you know, for a big, exciting announcement. So at least they didn't feel like they heard it in the street. You know what I mean?
Right. And did somebody say, is it Oprah? Is it Oprah?
No, I don't think anyone even thought that Oprah was in the mix. I mean, it's such a long shot thing. It doesn't come to, you don't think that someone you know would have any connection with Oprah Winfrey. You know
right.
what I mean?
Sure.
I mean, that has been one of the great pleasures of this, is that many times your accomplishments in the literary world are not legible to everyone. They don't quite know what this means. But everybody understands Oprah. Hmm. When I was in Las Vegas, the lady who lived across the street from me, she was an older lady. She was kind of hard of hearing. Her English wasn't fantastic. But, you know, we communicated as best we could. And One day, she knocked on the door very urgently. I opened it. I said, yes, ma'am, Ms. Martinez, what is it? And she had the Oprah magazine with my picture in it. Mm. And she said, you know Oprah? You know Oprah? And tears were standing in her eyes. Because everyone understands what it means to be an Oprah Book Club selection.
Sure. So one last question about that. So the day of the announcement happens, what is your life like that day?
I got up. I put on my, you know, I felt like a child putting on like my Easter dress. I put on my Easter dress. And the car picked me up and I picked up my publicist because he lives near me. And we were on our way to CBS This Morning. And he's kind of a prickly guy. Like, he's very New York, very, you know, just they're not all that emotional in New York. But I held his hand, whether he wanted his hand held or not. We were holding hands, riding to CBS This Morning. And I said, Michael, we did this. We pulled it off. And he says, don't jinx it until, you know, you get on the set. But I was surprised at how comfortable and confident I felt, because I did feel like the 5 months in between when I was told and the world was told, I had gotten my head right. I had written like 15 letters to friends saying, you know, my life is going to get very busy. I may not be in touch, but I want you to know how much I appreciate you, because I knew that my life was going to change and I wanted to shore up my relationships. So I felt like I had done everything in advance. I have to say, the letters arrived early and my friends were saying things like, you've written 3 other books and your life didn't get busy. Well, they thought I was just being dramatic. But I felt like I was ready, and I just sat down and talked to Gail King about why I wrote this book. And I talked about, you know, this issue of wrongful incarceration and the way that it impacts people's lives. I felt like I was doing something. I felt like it was meaningful. And it was really clear to me, too, that Oprah Winfrey had lent her good name to this work that I'm doing. And I wanted to make sure that I rose up to that challenge.
I want to come back around here to Atlanta. So my understanding is that you are getting ready to move back soon, right?
I am. I'm going back to my natural habitat. I'm returning to my home planet. Yes.
And what brought this on?
Well, a number of things. For one, you know, my daddy is 82, so he's in excellent health. But I'm also aware that when your parents get older, it is good to be home. Secondly, I've lived in New York about 10 years, and I am not a New Yorker. I'm just not one. And I am a Georgia peach, as they say. I'm just more comfortable at home. And so when the opportunity came to apply for a position at Emory University, I knew that everyone in the world would be applying for this job. But I put my hat in the, you know, put my name in the hat, or my hat in the ring. What is it?
Hat in the ring. Either one's fine.
Anyway, I applied for that thing. I applied for the job. And because I really also want to be in a position to work with young writers, young Southern writers. I did move to New York because New York is where publishing is. And I did feel that proximity would help me to further my career. But I feel that I have earned the right to go home now, that I have a career, and now I can just live where I want to live.
Well, welcome back eventually when you get here. And congratulations.
Well, I can't wait, actually.
And congratulations on your book and all the success. And thank you so much for talking to us, Terry.
Thanks for inviting me. It was fun.
Terry Jones is 47 years old. I mention her age for a reason. She's been a working writer for a long time, but only this year did An American Marriage, with Oprah's blessing, lift her into the literary big time. I hope you noticed the part in our conversation where she talked about being in her 20s, hauling a heavy old laptop into the women's room where she worked so she could steal a few moments to write. Most people in creative work need a day job to pay the bills until they can make a living doing what they love. Some people can never make a living at it. That's no reason to stop. It's nice to talk to someone like Thierry, who's reaping big rewards from her work. But you can't sit around and wait for Oprah to call. The work has to be the reward. And if you treat it that way, maybe one day the phone will ring.
Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Della Canal. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. If you have any thoughts about the show, ideas for future guests, or feelings about Chili Dogs at the Varsity, email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on wfae.org, Apple Podcasts, or the NPR One app. On the WFAE version, we have show notes and links with more information on that week's guests. Also, between episodes, look for the Southbound Radio Hour with a playlist of music based on the most recent episode. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.